Welcome to Transition, Gadgets 360's gaming and pop culture podcast. Today's episode is going to be dedicated to gaming phones because we are a bit depleted both in terms of health and strength. The Transition podcast is struggling to survive just like these things called gaming phones. Anyway, so games editor Rishi Alwani is here to define his existence and why gaming phones should exist.
Firstly, I don't think they're struggling. That's a bit of a misnomer right now considering there's so few to go around. That being said, gaming phones are essentially smartphones that have been positioned, branded, and sold as phones to be dedicated gaming devices. Now, obviously, since we've reached a point in the smartphone life cycle where, you know, anything 15,000-20,000 rupees or even less is will last long enough, manufacturers have to find new ways to, ask you to part with more of your money. And gaming phones seem to be one niche. We've seen Asus do this with the ROG phone, which has built-in triggers, that has a bunch of accessories with it. We've seen Razer do something similar with the Razer Phone and Razer Phone 2, which have high refresh rate screens. We've even seen Xiaomi do it with their Black Shark brand, which supports a really, NVIDIA-inspired black and green aesthetic. there are quite a few of them doing the rounds, but not all of them are in India.
Yeah, exactly. I'm your host, Pranay Parab, here to call, the crap that these companies sell us in terms of marketing. Well, I'm here to call that out. So, first things first, let's look at what gaming phones are and how much you have to spend. So, Rishi, you define gaming phones as like phones that have been marketed as something that, as a device that's for gaming. Yeah. But in my opinion, every phone should be a gaming phone as long as, it has a decent enough, powerful enough chipset powering it.
Yeah, I think that's a fair estimate. And I would have agreed with you until the launch of the OnePlus 6. Hmm. Because when that phone came out, there were a ton of people asking me, messaging me, asking if it's good enough for PUBG, if it's good enough for Asphalt, if it's good enough for Clash Royale, Clash of Clans. And these are guys, my simple question then was, how often do you play games on your smartphone? What's the frequency like? And these guys are like extended. There seems to be a growing hardcore niche of players who play around a couple of hours a day on their smartphones. And for them, they're upgrading from stuff like a Nexus 5. They're upgrading from stuff like a 6P. They're upgrading from stuff like, a OnePlus 3T. And they seem to be the hardcore niche towards which these devices are targeted to. Hmm. But at the same time, if you think about it, you really don't need a quote-unquote gaming phone to get the job done. Simply because, let's look at some of the features these phones have, right? They all, two of the bigger ones, the Asus ROG phone and the Razer phone, sport 90Hz and 120Hz refresh rate displays. Now, what that basically means is you can play the game at higher frame rates, above 60fps, and get a very smooth, buttery experience. But here's the thing. PUBG and Fortnite on phones are locked at 30fps. Great. You're not going to see a benefit there. Mm. Unless you're the sort who plays Shadowgun Legends or Warhammer Freeblade or Titanfall Assault, you're not going to see the benefit of those high refresh rate screens. So if you're playing the most popular stuff, like PUBG and Fortnite, they don't support them. Yeah. So that's one issue right there. Secondly, if you look at the peripherals these come with, right? Both the Xiaomi Black Shark and the Asus ROG come with their own controller peripherals. Now, again, when you look at popular games like Fortnite and PUBG, accessories manufacturers have told us that they've had issues having their peripherals to work with smartphones because PUBG's anti-cheat is in such a way that devices keep getting banned, accounts keep getting banned. So, in some cases, particularly if you're playing a lot of the, mass market stuff like PUBG, Fortnite, you may run into issues, which is why, it seems to be a bit of a misnomer at this stage.
Yeah, indeed. So, you know what I think personally, while you're putting out a phone that is dedicated to gaming, etc., is like a really good thought in terms of making gaming more portable. But to be honest, I think it's not like the PC market where, a gaming PC means you had a more powerful graphics card and a CPU that could handle the latest games, etc. It's really not as simple as that because most chipsets that are there in the market these days in the 10,000 plus price bracket at least, most of them are pretty good for gaming. That's one. Second thing is, the way you describe this whole thing, it seems to me like these gaming phones are targeted more at esports people, the one who go to these competitions to play PUBG and then, realize that the competition was a complete scam and, lots of things happening there were not supposed to happen. But I don't think that audience is big enough for people to care.
I don't know. I mean, that's an interesting point you bring up, that there's not enough differentiation from the hardware standpoint. Some of them actually do. Like in Asus's case, and in, I think, Nubia's case, with their smartphones, they try cherry-picking SoCs. So with Asus with the ROG, they'll try grabbing a Snapdragon 845 that clocks just a bit higher. So for example, if you have the Razer Phone 2 that has a Snapdragon SoC at 2.8, Asus's will do 2.96 gigahertz. So they try to eke out a little bit more performance. But then again, that's on specific devices. It's not across the board. And the other part of it, which is interesting, is some dedicated gaming phones, right? Like the Honor Play, for example, which did have an India release. Good price, 20,000 rupees, decent deal. But because it's using a Kirin 970 SoC, certain games like Asphalt 9 on release did not support it. It took 2 to 3 weeks for that support to come in because the developers will prioritize devices that have a larger prevalence, which is basically anything Snapdragon, then onto other things. So that's another thing to keep in mind, that while in some cases you may have cherry-picked hardware, like even Huawei tends to do their own GPU tuning, which is more of a software tweak. And these are some of the ways the manufacturers are trying to give a bit of difference. But again, like I said, if game developers aren't playing ball, if game developers are, you know, going to prioritize, have their own set of priorities, it doesn't exactly come together. And I think that's a lot of what we're seeing.
Yeah, so what we've seen is that the maker of PUBG, Tencent, was testing a game called PUBG Lite in some markets, such as the Philippines and all. So these game makers, they're making most of the money from people who don't have really powerful devices. So the idea is that, you know, while PUBG will not run very well on phones that don't have 4GB RAM, and, you know, even with 4GB RAM, it sometimes struggles on certain devices. It won't give you the highest possible frame rate and all. The idea behind these games is that you make them more accessible. And I don't think gaming phones as of now are very accessible. So just to like throw in an example there. Now, I think Honor marketed this phone called Honor Play as a gaming smartphone, the sub 20,000 rupee price bracket. But if you look at it, I mean, there are phones that start at 10,000 rupees now, such as the Zenfone Max Pro M1, which are, I would say, at least like, you know, almost as good at gaming as well. It's not like, you know, they are far behind or something. So the price difference is huge, right? It's twice the price in terms of what you look at, like for an Honor Play and for a Zenfone Max Pro M1. Now, I would look at it as a gaming company, and on Android as it is, you know, monetization is not exactly easy, right? So you monetize via ads, etc. So as a gaming company, like if I'm in that business where I'm making games for Android, of all places, I know that the paying crowd is not going to come in very easily. So I would look at targeting the devices where the entry barrier is low, where I can serve a bunch of ads and start making money. And then once people are hooked, maybe then ask them to buy these tiny in-app purchases once in a while to make, you know, continuing revenue.
I think that's the mentality that's probably driving the fact that we're not seeing a lot of these phones release in India. We don't have the Razer phone. We didn't get the Razer phone 2 either. The Asus ROG phone hasn't released yet at the time of recording this podcast, and we have no clarity if it's coming.
Same with the Xiaomi Black Shark.
And same with the Xiaomi Black Shark. Because at the end of the day, in India, mobile gaming is a mass market. That being said, to me, it seems that the thought process for these devices is kind of first world. I mean, if you look at markets which monetize, right? It's the US, it's South Korea, it's Japan. For Android, these are the three bigger markets. Parts of Asia, yes, China, but then China mainly on third-party app store, yep, not Google Play.
No Google Play.
And that's where these niches seem to be taken care of, you know? That's where the markets seem to be for these devices, but that being said, there still are some salient non-gaming related features that these gaming phones have, which could be worth taking a look at. Like, for example, both the Xiaomi and the Razer Phone 2 both run near stock Android. Hmm. And regardless which market you're in, that's a big plus point. In fact, the Razer Phone 2 goes to the extent of including Nova Launcher Prime.
Hmm.
It's that bare bones, which I think is really great because it's easier to use, it's more fluid, there's no drama. And at the same time, a lot of these devices have great batteries. Whatever we've discussed so far, I'm not sure on the Honor Play, but nearly everything else has at least a 4000 mAh battery, which means that you're getting at least a full day of use, if not more. Some of them have better cooling, like in the case of the Note 9, which is also marketed as a gaming phone because of the tie-in with Fortnite, uses their own form of quote-unquote liquid cooling, which is essentially a giant heatsink. Now, these are great features. These are nice to have. And I mean, if you're looking at it from a durability standpoint, if you're the sort who, you know, uses your phone to the max, uses your device on a regular basis, yeah, these features are great to have. And which kind of makes me wonder, right? How soon before we see these kind of features get ported over? I mean, if you ask me, Apple's done a great job with that. I mean, especially with the screen tech, which we're seeing slowly trickle down from the iPads to the iPhones. We're seeing True Tone being available on anything iPhone 8 onwards. So it's just a matter of time before they decide to bring the high refresh rate along with it. At least they're bringing that there. Which is, again, brings the point, right? Do you want a gaming phone or do you want an iOS device that actually gets the games faster? A lot of the big releases tend to go iOS first for a reason, because they monetize better, because it's a more uniform testbed. There's less drama in terms of dev. And we saw with Fortnite. Fortnite's mobile release was spearheaded on iOS. We're probably going to see the same thing with Elder Scrolls Blades, which is going to be probably iOS first, considering it was shown off at the iPhone event.
Hmm.
So it's a question of where you want to go, right? Do you want a quote-unquote gaming phone, which may get wonky support from developers, or do you want to go where games come first, which is usually iOS at this stage?
Yeah, so that is a very good point. And also, I would like to bring up the fact that Apple has really been killing it with the hardware with each generation. Their silicon team has been really putting out some chipsets that are really, really powerful. And so far, what we've seen is Android has been at least like a year and a half behind in terms of the, you know, chipset power. So now they launched the iPad Pro, right? The 11-inch and the 12.9-inch, the new ones. So they have the A12X chip. So you get the best hardware there, and you know, in terms of games also, you get some really high quality titles. But you know, it's not like Apple's platform is without its issues. So game developers keep complaining that you have to continuously pay like $100 a year as like a license fee sort of a thing to stay on the Apple dev platform and keep your app on the App Store, which is, I think, a pretty high price to pay in terms of like, you know, once you're on the store, you have to be keep constantly making that money, right? You know, so that doesn't give them motivation to sort of optimize games. So when the 32-bit to 64-bit shift happened, a lot of the developers realized that, okay, our games have been on the App Store for a long time, but they're not really making that much money. So it's not worth it investing that much time and energy into updating it and making it relevant for the next few years of the iOS lineup. So iOS has had these issues for sure. But overall, I'd still say it's the better gaming platform for in terms of like whatever we see on portable. Maybe Nintendo Switch is an exception, which I would say is better than iOS at this point in terms of the titles available.
In fact, it's funny you bring up the Switch, right? Because if you look at what's been going on with the Nintendo Switch quote-unquote ecosystem for games at this stage, we're seeing a bit of a trend where mobile games that would be, I don't know, probably $3, $4, $5 are being sold on the Switch for $15, $20, $25.
Mm.
We're seeing that happen, and people are buying them. Which is even more interesting, which probably goes to show that, yes, in terms of a handheld market, that is an underserved market. That is an audience that's willing to pay. And we saw the same behavior on the Vita as well, to a smaller degree, where developers of visual novels, developers of Japanese RPGs, actually got their return on investment just making him on Vita, because the audience does pick him up and does actually, you know, spend on those games. So, the way I see it, it's a lot more fractured. I mean, on one end, you have the mass audience that's only free to play, that'll only play stuff like PUBG, Fortnite, Clash Royale, Clash of Clans, you know, the popular stuff, or even cricket games, like Real Cricket for that matter. But, and then you have a more discerning audience on iOS that's willing to spend on indie titles, that's willing to spend and experiment with purchases. And then you have the guys on Switch who actually spend quite a bit. I mean, the attach rates first year were through the roof. I think 5 to 7 games per Switch, which is pretty crazy if you think about it.
Yeah, considering that Nintendo hasn't really done many great bundles, and Nintendo bundles, like until this Black Friday sale, all Nintendo bundles were essentially like, you buy this console, you buy this game, the total price is console plus game.
Yeah, but then, I agree completely. That is that's been their bundle strategy for a while. I mean, we've seen some changes, like with the Diablo bundle that actually has custom engravings, that with the Pokemon bundles that seem to have custom artwork. So those seem to turn the tide a bit, but I do agree that seems to be their strategy. All of this actually then boils down to one thing, right? Like, if you're the sort who games heavily on your mobile device, do you really need a gaming phone? You have so many other options. And frankly speaking, I think we're not at that stage where they can justify their value yet. Because let's be honest, do you really want to spend, I don't know, hypothetically, something for a Razer phone, like $800, whatever the India price is, probably 50, 60K, assuming it ever makes it here? Or would you rather spend 20 to 30K on a Poco phone, which has similar spec, 8 gigs of RAM, a Snapdragon SoC? Fine, not the greatest screen in the known universe, all right? But it has hefty cooling. It has a great battery. Like you get 4,000 mAh on something like that. Would you really then look, if you look at that, if you look at that value category in Android and compare it to the gaming phones, there is almost a lot of similarity. Similar with the OnePlus 6 and 6T, right? I mean, you get similar spec. Fine. Maybe not as heavy duty in terms of cooling or build quality or ergonomics, but good enough to go along. And I think that's where the real play is, at least for Indian consumers who want to buy a gaming phone at this stage, if at all.
Yeah, so, you know, when you mention Indian consumers, it's like funny that I actually spoke about iOS a little while ago. Mm. I mean, as of now, thanks to Apple's amazing pricing strategy, the iOS ecosystem in India is just like constantly shrinking, in my opinion, compared to Android.
Oh, yeah, it's basically become gray market or don't buy.
Yeah, exactly. So that is one reason why I think like people are sort of missing out on a really good portable platform. Now, we've seen some really good titles come to iOS at like pretty reasonable prices now. A title like The Witness, the full game is on iOS for like 800 rupees MRP. Mm. So if you look at the PC price, it was something like $40 in the US.
Yeah.
So 800 rupees is like nothing compared to that, and you get the full game. Yep. And you also have controllers on iOS which let you have the, you know, full proper experience.
Yep.
So similarly, we've seen a bunch of other games coming in. Like most recently, I think Civ 6 was the one, the strategy game.
Yeah, it was actually surprisingly good. That was on both iPad and iPhone. We played it on iPhone. It's surprisingly competent, all said and done. Yes, they cut a few corners in terms of animation, in terms of detail, but it is pretty good.
I mean, it is the real deal, right? Yeah, it's a full game as it was on PC.
Yep.
Yeah, so that is really good to see. It's very heartening to see these games coming to iOS. But unfortunately, in India, iOS and Apple's strategies are just like, I don't know, they may be catering to the like 0.01% who have all the cash in the world, and for them, like buying an iPhone is like pocket change.
But then again, the counterpoint to that is that 0.01% would also probably have access to cutting edge hardware on PC or console. Yeah. So then what's the point?
So that portable platform in India is suffering a lot, although, you know, internationally the scene may be different. Yeah. But if you look at Android, I don't think the ecosystem is ready to be like a proper gaming ecosystem. I mean, at the end of the day, see, even if you have thousands of apps, even if you have like pretty much all the major apps out there, if you're relying on this free-to-play model with ads to like get people in, then that's not exactly going to work in favor of, you know, most developers out there. So now, as usual, like as has been happening in real life, there is a small chunk of developers who make it big on these stores and they are making all the money out there. But there are a large chunk of people behind them who are not making as much money and for whom being on these platforms is not as lucrative. Now, you mentioned the Switch and how like indie games are like selling for higher prices there. I'm actually completely on board with that. Now, there's a game called A Normal Lost Phone, which keeps going on sale on iOS. Essentially, it's not even a game. It's like there's a phone inside your phone and you're just trying to figure out what details are there. The person who got lost, like whose phone was lost, you're trying to find out more about their life and like what happened. It's a very arty game, and that, like, I bought it for, I think, 120 rupees on iOS. So it's a throwaway price for a really nice game. On the Switch, I think the same game was selling for $5 or something. Now, as a developer, would you rather put your game on a platform where you'll earn 120 rupees, a platform where you can only make money when your game is free to play with ads, or a platform where you can make $5 per sale and like where people are actually buying these games?
I don't know. I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it, because each platform has its own advantages and disadvantages. Like, for example, if you're going free to play, you will need a user acquisition budget. You will need to spend on marketing above and beyond what Google may or may not feature you with. That's really important. And I have heard from certain developers that Google won't feature you until they see your conversions, the number of people that actually download your game for free but then end up transacting on it and buying IAPs, in-app purchases and microtransactions. Then only they'll feature you. So that's one challenge right there.
And also, it's not a manually curated store, right?
Exactly.
On the App Store, iOS, at least you get like a story thing out there. Like people, journalists interview you and then the story is put up there.
Exactly.
So you have a chance of getting more visibility.
Exactly. And then if you also look at Switch, right, with Nintendo, Nintendo is notoriously picky when it comes to who they work with. From what I've heard from developers, the good thing with Nintendo, at least, is that the people they work on Nintendo side are all ex-game developers, so they know exactly what you need and how to go about it. But at the same time, getting featured is becoming a challenge, because at the end of the day, there's only limited space you have on the Switch storefront, on the Nintendo eShop storefront. All three of them have similar challenges in a way. You need to get featured, you need to get it out there. But yeah, it's a question of what you're building for, right? And to be honest, I think the way we're seeing things going is that a lot of developers seem to be taking the path of least resistance, which is the Nintendo Switch at this stage. There's more value to be had. But how long until that runs out? Because we've seen this in the past, where first it used to be Steam. Steam used to be the gold mine. Then it was the PlayStation Store until AAA showed up. Then it was iOS, Android for a while, and then now Nintendo Switch. So where next, what happens next is going to be a point of interest for those involved. What does this mean for you as a consumer? Well, it just depends on what you like to play. If you like to play multiplayer, free-to-play stuff, yeah, stick with Android. If you're looking for more curated, slightly more expensive games, but different experiences, stick with iOS or the Switch.
Yeah, exactly. So with the Switch, at least I will give them this. There is a physical version of pretty much every game out there. Some indie releases will not be there, but most major titles will be there on physical. Even if you have to download some, I don't know, hundreds of GBs of data after getting the console, at least there is still a physical version out there. So with iOS, I've seen that the only way you can connect to the device is Wi-Fi. And, you know, in our office and in certain other places where I hang out, the Wi-Fi is notoriously bad. So downloading a 3GB game without like having 6 different interruptions is, you know, sometimes a challenge. Whereas on the Switch, even though the Wi-Fi is bad, like I've noticed at least some physical games, they work just fine. You just put in the cartridge and it starts working. So you also have to keep that little thing in mind before you, you know, pick your gaming platform. And final thing I'd like to probably mention is that there have been a bunch of these studies floating around from various companies which say that gaming phones are the future and this and that. As of now, I don't buy all that because, to be honest, phones are here to stay, that everyone knows. Also, we'll have some phones with like superb chipsets which can drive even the best of games out there. I mean, I'm looking at your Fortnite, you unoptimized, you know, game out there. They can run these things and they will be able to run it increasingly easily at lower price points, I am very sure. But whether gaming phones, especially like dedicated gaming phones, will take over the world, I highly doubt that.
I think a lot of the hype and push around that also stems from certain companies that have a lot of investment in the mobile space. Blizzard, for example. You have Hearthstone, you have the Diablo Immortal coming out. Or if you look at Supercell, right? They've made their money on mobile. So that's where a lot of the push seems to be coming from. Tencent, for example, is no small part of that, particularly with PUBG Mobile.
Yeah, what about Valve now and with that Artifact thing?
Artifact on iOS, Android is coming later, right? Yeah. Now it's PC. But yeah. My point is, you have a lot of high-profile, powerful developers looking to bring their content to mobile. So for them, whatever is required to perpetuate the ecosystem is fair game. And until we see a tangible differentiator, which is unlikely, a really tangible, massive differentiator, aside from cherry-picked SoCs, aside from, you know, faster screens with better refresh rate, it's going to be a really tough sell for most consumers. Because when you look at the price tag on a lot of these things, Asus's ROG phone, I think, is around $800 to $900. Would you really want to spend that much on an Android device? Or would you rather, you know, spend a bit less, get something with a better camera that has better all-around use, like maybe a Pixel 3 or maybe even a Note 9, which has multifaceted use cases thanks to the stylus? Your choices are immense. And unless there's some really tangible, worthwhile differentiation that goes beyond a cosmetic skin in Fortnite, which is what Samsung did, it's going to be a tough sell for most consumers.
Yeah, exactly. And even that Fortnite thing that Samsung did, it's not like that deal lasted very long, right? You can't do a permanently exclusive thing with
cosmetics you can, but then again, what's the value in it for consumers? Exactly. Is there any long-term value? I don't think so.
Yeah, same here. All right, so Rishi, have you played something this week? I've been too unwell, so
I have been playing Hitman 2. It is glorious. Well, probably one of the best games this year and one of the best murder simulators in a long time. It is so good. So Hitman 2 basically takes place right after 2016's Hitman. The good news is, the online connectivity is a lot more stable. And that's required in a game like this because a lot of your unlocks, a lot of the weapons, starting points in a level, disguises, those only unlock if you're online for some stupid reason. And this time around is a lot more stable. I only had one issue at the very beginning, but that's it. It looks quite clean, looks really good. And I think the bigger differentiator isn't the fact that it looks clean and good, it's just that the scale is a lot bigger.
Hmm.
So you have missions that take you to Mumbai, complete with slums, complete with chawls, complete with sewers.
Yeah.
Yeah, they actually go to that degree of simulating sewers.
And I also saw a stall with like misspelled Shivpuri.
Yeah, and there's like more. Shivpuri. There's even an entire area that's just a giant laundry. A giant like place.
What, Dhobi Ghat?
More than that. It is on another level. It's not even Dhobi Ghat. It looks like Dhobi Ghat, but it's not.
Okay.
And then you have something like that Bandra crossing for the Bandra bridge, which is there for train to go above the station.
Mm-hmm.
You have that huge bridge.
Like a skywalk.
Yeah, you have the skywalk. There are like unfinished buildings that remind me of Lower Parel. You have parts of the streets that are like the narrow lanes of Fort near the Stock Exchange. It is insane. Mm. The level of detail is insane. And, the accents of the NPCs are a little annoying. I wonder who dubbed those. I mean, you guys, they should just learn from Ubisoft and get actual Indians to dub that.
Yeah, but, or just, you know, listen to this podcast and put our voices in. The fee is only 1 crore per annum.
Lol, IO Interactive if you're listening. But yeah, jokes aside, it's pretty good. So like the Mumbai level was really nice. It had some really cliched Bollywood movements, which kind of hint at a possible casting couch scenario with one of the villains in that level. There's some cool stuff you can do in terms of disguises. There's some really cool things you can do in general across the game. Like you actually can spy, sneak into someone's apartment and spy on them, and a lot of weird stuff. But it's pretty good. So the Mumbai level was a highlight for me. The Miami level was just as good because it takes place on a racetrack, and then there's a huge area around it. And they really emphasized on scale this time, and it felt like each level could keep you enraptured for hours. And this is not, and fine, while you had these big levels like Miami and Mumbai, there were some small scale levels that are just as good. Like there was one in Vermont where it's literally a 2-lane, 3-lane suburban street, which could have been Wisteria Lane for all I care from Desperate Housewives. Not like I watched the show. But anyway, so point is, and over there, right, even though it's a small contained area versus, you know, Mumbai versus Miami versus even the final level of the game, which quite insane. It still allowed you so many things to do. You could disguise yourself as a pest control guy and gas your enemies, and it's a lot of fun. To me, this is like perhaps, I mean, the biggest problem with Hitman 2 is the story. Mm. Everything else is on par. The gameplay is refined to hell and back. The fact that you get great value because all the levels of Hitman 2016 are playable in Hitman 2 engine, which means you also get the updates of Hitman 2 in those games retroactively. So, for example, in Hitman 2016, mirrors wouldn't work. Enemies couldn't see you from mirrors, so they fixed that. Hitman 2 has a social stealth mechanic where you can see if you're blending in with an audience. That goes back in Hitman 2016, which you can play through. So they've done some interesting stuff. What really bums me out, though, is that all my progress from Hitman 2016 doesn't carry over. So I have to play those levels again in Hitman 2 for them to carry over. So, but then that aside, and the fact that the story is, I mean, supremely weak, it's really, really good. Like, I can't remember this much fun I've had with a game in this year that wasn't Spider-Man or God of War.
God of War.
It is so good.
Or if you replayed Persona 5.
Oh, yeah, too. So, yeah, but this is good. This is a lot of fun. I've been playing mainly that. Then there's a bit of Battlefield 5, which was, I mean, Battlefield and quite nondescript. What really bummed me out is that while the single-player campaign is actually competent, it starts off super preachy, like a moral science textbook, and that kind of bummed me out. It was just like, you felt it downhill from there, even though it wasn't. The multiplayer is fun, though. A lot of emphasis on team combat, team skill. So, that should be fun. I mean, over a period of time. Mainly those two.
All right, then. I think that's all we have for this episode of Transition. And we will see you with another episode next week, when hopefully we'll be back to full strength and not as unwell. In the meantime, do check out our Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and Instagram pages at Gadgets360. You can also write to us with your feedback, your questions, your comments at podcast@gadgets360.com. The music for this episode comes via Magnus Solai Paulson, whose album PPP PPP is where the tracks are from. If you use one of these fancy apps to listen to podcasts, such as Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, please do rate us, like the show, subscribe to the show. Your ratings, your reviews, your subscriptions, they help us a lot. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll be back in 1 week.